Section 1. Length of the working day and intensity of labour constant. Productiveness of labour variable. On these assumptions, the value of labour power and the magnitude of surplus value are determined by three laws. 1. A working day of given length always creates the same amount of value, no matter how the productiveness of labour and with it the mass of the product and the price of each single commodity produced may vary. If the value created by a working day of 12 hours be, say, 6 shillings, then although the mass of the articles produced varies with the productiveness of labour, the only result is that the value represented by 6 shillings is spread over a greater or lesser number of articles. 2. Surplus value and the value of labour power vary in opposite directions. A variation in the productiveness of labour, its increase or diminution, causes a variation in the opposite direction in the value of labour power, and in the same direction in surplus value. The value created by a working day of 12 hours is a constant quantity, say 6 shillings. This constant quantity is the sum of the surplus value plus the value of the labour power, which latter value the labourer replaces by an equivalent. It is self-evident that if a constant quantity consists of two parts, neither of them can increase without the other diminishing. Let the two parts at starting be equal. 3 shillings value of labour power, 3 shillings surplus value. Then the value of the labour power cannot rise from 3 shillings to 4 without the surplus value falling from 3 shillings to 2, and the surplus value cannot rise from 3 shillings to 4 without the value of labour power falling from 3 shillings to 2. Under these circumstances, therefore, no change can take place in the absolute magnitude either of the surplus value or of the value of labour power without a simultaneous change in their relative magnitudes, that is, relatively to each other. It is impossible for them to rise or fall simultaneously. Further, the value of labour power cannot fall, and consequently surplus value cannot rise, without a rise in the productiveness of labour. For instance, in this case, the value of the labour power cannot sink from 3 shillings to 2, unless an increase in the productiveness of labour makes it possible to produce in 4 hours the same quantity of necessaries as previously required 6 hours to produce. On the other hand, the value of the labour power cannot rise from 3 shillings to 4 without a decrease in the productiveness of labour, whereby 8 hours become requisite to produce the same quantity of necessaries for the production of which 6 hours previously sufficed. It follows from this that an increase in the productiveness of labour causes a fall in the value of labour power and a consequent rise in surplus value, while on the other hand, a decrease in such productiveness causes a rise in the value of labour power and a fall in surplus value. In formulating this law, Ricardo overlooked one circumstance. Although a change in the magnitude of the surplus value or surplus labour causes a change in the opposite direction in the magnitude of the value of labour power or in the quantity of necessary labour, it by no means follows that they vary in the same proportion. They do increase or diminish by the same quantity, but their proportional increase or diminution depends on their original magnitudes before the change in the productiveness of labour took place. If the value of the labour power be 4 shillings, or the necessary labour time 8 hours, and the surplus value be 2 shillings, or the surplus labour 4 hours, and if, in consequence of an increase in the productiveness of labour, the value of the labour power fall to 3 shillings, or the necessary labour to 6 hours, the surplus value will rise to 3 shillings, or the surplus labour to 6 hours. The same quantity, 1 shilling or 2 hours, is added in one case and subtracted in the other. but the proportional change of magnitude is different in each case. While the value of the labour power falls from 4 shillings to 3, that is by 1/4 or 25%, the surplus value rises from 2 shillings to 3, that is, by 1/2, or 50%. It therefore follows that the proportional increase, or diminution in surplus value consequent on a given change in the productiveness of labour, depends on the original magnitude of that portion of the working day which embodies itself in surplus value. The smaller that portion, the greater is the proportional change. The greater that portion, the less is the proportional change. 3. Increase or diminution in surplus value is always consequent on, and never the cause of, the corresponding diminution or increase in the value of labour power. Footnote. To this third law, McCulloch has made, amongst others, this absurd addition, that a rise in surplus value, unaccompanied by a fall in the value of labour power, can occur through the abolition of taxes payable by the capitalist. The abolition of such taxes makes no change whatever in the quantity of surplus value that the capitalist extorts at first hand from the labourer. It alters only the proportion in which that surplus value is divided between himself and third persons. It consequently makes no alteration whatever in the relation between surplus value and the value of labour power. McCulloch's exception, therefore, proves only his misapprehension of the rule, a misfortune that as often happens to him in the vulgarisation of Ricardo, as it does to J.B. Say, in the vulgarisation of Adam Smith. End of footnote. Since the working day is constant in magnitude, and is represented by a value of constant magnitude, since to every variation in the magnitude of surplus value there corresponds an inverse variation in the value of labour power, and since the value of labour power cannot change, except in consequence of a change in the productiveness of labour, it clearly follows, under these conditions, that every change of magnitude in surplus value arises from an inverse change of magnitude in the value of labour power. If, then, as we have already seen, there can be no change of absolute magnitude in the value of labour power and in surplus value unaccompanied by a change in their relative magnitudes, so now it follows that no change in their relative magnitudes is possible without a previous change in the absolute magnitude of the value of labour power. According to the third law, a change in the magnitude of surplus value presupposes a movement in the value of labour power, which movement is brought about by a variation in the productiveness of labour. The limit of this change is given by the altered value of labour power. Nevertheless, even when circumstances allow the law to operate, subsidiary movements may occur. For example, if in consequence of the increased productiveness of labour the value of labour power falls from 4 shillings to 3, or the necessary labour time from 8 hours to 6, the price of labour power may possibly not fall below 3 shillings and 8 pence, 3 shillings and 6 pence, or 3 shillings and 2 pence, and the surplus value consequently not rise above 3 shillings and 4 pence, 3 shillings and 6 pence, or 3 shillings and 10 pence. The amount of this fall, the lowest limit of which is 3 shillings, the new value of labour power, depends on the relative weight which the pressure of capital on the one side and the resistance of the labourer on the other throws into the scale. The value of labour power is determined by the value of a given quantity of necessaries. It is the value and not the mass of these necessaries that varies with the productiveness of labour. It is, however, possible that, owing to an increase of productiveness, both the labourer and the capitalist may simultaneously be able to appropriate a greater quantity of these necessaries, without any change in the price of labour power or in surplus value. If the value of labour power be 3 shillings, and the necessary labour time amount to 6 hours, if the surplus value likewise be 3 shillings, and the surplus labour 6 hours, then if the productiveness of labour were doubled without altering the ratio of necessary labour to surplus labour, there would be no change of magnitude in surplus value and price of labour power. The only result would be that each of them would represent twice as many use values as before, these use values being twice as cheap as before. Although labour power would be unchanged in price, it would be above its value. If, however, the price of labour power had fallen not to 1 and sixpence, the lowest possible point consistent with its new value, but to 2 shillings and 10pence or 2 shillings and 6pence, still this lower price would represent an increased mass of necessaries. In this way, it is possible, with an increasing productiveness of labour, for the price of labour power to keep on falling, and yet this fall to be accompanied by a constant growth in the mass of the labourer's means of subsistence. But even in such case, the fall in the value of labour power would cause a corresponding rise of surplus value, and thus the abyss between the labourer's position and that of the capitalist would keep widening. Footnote. When an alteration takes place in the productiveness of industry, and that either more or less is produced by a given quantity of labour and capital, the proportion of wages may obviously vary, whilst the quantity, which that proportion represents, remains the same. Or the quantity may vary, whilst the proportion remains the same. Outlines of Political Economy, etc. End of footnote. Ricardo was the first who accurately formulated the three laws we have stated, but he falls into the following errors. 1. He looks upon the special conditions under which these laws hold good as the general and sole conditions of capitalist production. He knows no change either in the length of the working day or in the intensity of labour. Consequently, with him, there can be only one variable factor, viz. The productiveness of labour. 2. And this error vitiates his analysis much more than 1. He has not, any more than have the other economists, investigated surplus value as such, that is, independently of its particular forms such as profit, rent, etc. He therefore confounds together the laws of the rate of surplus value and the laws of the rate of profit. The rate of profit is, as we have already said, the ratio of the surplus value to the total capital advanced. The rate of surplus value is the ratio of the surplus value to the variable part of that capital. Assume that a capital of £500 is made up of raw material, instruments of labour, etc., to the amount of £400, call this C, and of wages to the amount of £100, call this V, and further, that the surplus value, S, equals £100. Then we have the rate of surplus value, S over V, equals £100 over £100, equals 100%. But the rate of profit, S over C, equals £100 over £500, equals 20%. It is, besides, obvious that the rate of profit may depend on circumstances that in no way affect the rate of surplus value. I shall show in Book 3 that with a given rate of surplus value, we may have any number of rates of profit, and that various rates of surplus value may, under given conditions, express themselves in a single rate of profit. Section 2. Working day constant, productiveness of labour constant, intensity of labour variable. Increased intensity of labour means increased expenditure of labour in a given time. Hence, a working day of more intense labour is embodied in more products than is one of less intense labour, the length of each day being the same. Increased productiveness of labour also, it is true, will supply more products in a given working day, But in this latter case, the value of each single product falls, for it costs less labour than before. In the former case, the value remains unchanged, for each article costs the same labour as before. Here we have an increase in the number of products unaccompanied by a fall in their individual prices. As their number increases, so does the sum of their prices. But in the case of increased productiveness, a given value is spread over a greater mass of products, hence the length of the working day being constant, a day's labour of increased intensity will be incorporated in an increased value, and the value of money remaining unchanged in more money. The value created varies with the extent to which the intensity of labour deviates from its normal intensity in the society. A given working day, therefore, no longer creates a constant but a variable value. In a day of 12 hours of ordinary intensity, the value created is, say, 6 shillings, but with increased intensity, the value created may be 7, 8, or more shillings. It is clear that if the value created by a day's labour increases from, say, 6 to 8 shillings, then the two parts into which the value is divided, viz. Price of labour power and surplus value, both of them may increase simultaneously, and either equally or unequally. They may both simultaneously increase from 3 shillings to 4. Here the rise in the price of labour power does not necessarily imply that the price has risen above the value of labour power. On the contrary, the rise in price may be accompanied by a fall in value. This occurs whenever the rise in the price of labour power does not compensate for its increased wear and tear. We know that, with transitory exceptions, a change in the productiveness of labour does not cause any change in the value of labour power, nor consequently in the magnitude of surplus value, unless the products of the industries affected are articles habitually consumed by the labourers. In the present case, this condition no longer applies. For when the variation is either in the duration or in the intensity of labour, there is always a corresponding change in the magnitude of the value created, independently of the nature of the article in which that value is embodied. If the intensity of labour were to increase simultaneously and equally in every branch of industry, then the new and higher degree of intensity would become the normal degree for the society, and would therefore cease to be taken into account of. But still, even then, the intensity of labour would be different in different countries, and would modify the international application of the law of value. The more intense working day of one nation would be represented by a greater sum of money than would the less intense day of another nation. Footnote. All things being equal, the English manufacturer can turn out a considerably larger amount of work in a given time than a foreign manufacturer, so much as to counterbalance the difference of the working days between 60 hours a week here and 72 or 80 elsewhere. Report of Inspector of Factories, 1855. The most infallible means for reducing this qualitative difference between the English and continental working hour would be a law shortening quantitatively the length of the working day in continental factories. End of footnote. Section 3. Productiveness and intensity of labour constant, length of the working day variable. The working day may vary in two ways. It may be made either longer or shorter. From our present data, and within the limits of the assumptions made before, we obtain the following laws. 1. The working day creates a greater or lesser amount of value in proportion to its length. Thus, a variable and not a constant quantity of value. 2. Every change in the relation between the magnitudes of surplus value and of the value of labour power arises from a change in the absolute magnitude of the surplus labour, and consequently of the surplus value. 3. The absolute value of labour power can change only in consequence of the reaction exercised by the prolongation of surplus labour upon the wear and tear of labour power. Every change in this absolute value is therefore the effect, but never the cause, of a change in the magnitude of surplus value. We begin with the case in which the working day is shortened. A. A shortening of the working day under the conditions just given leaves the value of labour power, and with it the necessary labour time, unaltered. It reduces the surplus labour and surplus value. Along with the absolute magnitude of the latter, its relative magnitude also falls, that is, its magnitude relatively to the value of labour power, whose magnitude remains unaltered. Only by lowering the price of labour power below its value could the capitalist save himself harm. All the usual arguments against the shortening of the working day assume that it takes place under the conditions we have here supposed to exist. But in reality, the very contrary is the case. A change in the productiveness and intensity of labour either precedes or immediately follows a shortening of the working day. Footnote. There are compensating circumstances which the working of the 10 Hours Act has brought to light. Report of Inspector of Factories, 1848. End of footnote. B. Lengthening of the working day. Let the necessary labour time be 6 hours, or the value of labour power 3 shillings. Also let the surplus labour be 6 hours, or the surplus value 3 shillings. The whole working day then amounts to 12 hours, and is embodied in a value of 6 shillings. If now the working day be lengthened by 2 hours, and the price of labour power remain unaltered, the surplus value increases both absolutely and relatively. Although there is no absolute change in the value of labour power, it suffers a relative fall. Under the conditions assumed in 1, there could not be a change of relative magnitude in the value of labour power without a change in its absolute magnitude. Here, on the contrary, the change of relative magnitude in the value of labour power is the result of the change of absolute magnitude in surplus value. Since the value in which a day's labour is embodied increases with the length of that day, it is evident that the surplus value and the price of labour power may simultaneously increase either by equal or unequal quantities. This simultaneous increase is therefore possible in 2 cases. 1, the actual lengthening of the working day. The other, an increase in the intensity of labour unaccompanied by such lengthening. When the working day is prolonged, the price of labour power may fall below its value, although that price be nominally unchanged or even rise. The value of a day's labour power is, as will be remembered, estimated from its normal average duration, or from the normal duration of life among labourers, and from corresponding normal transformations of organised bodily matter into motion, in conformity with the nature of man. Footnote. The amount of labour which a man had undergone in the course of 24 hours might be approximately arrived at by an examination of the chemical changes which had taken place in his body, changed forms in matter, indicating the anterior exercise of dynamic force. Grove, On the Correlation of Physical Forces. End of footnote. Up to a certain point, the increased wear and tear of labour power, inseparable from a lengthened working day, may be compensated by higher wages. But beyond this point, the wear and tear increases in geometrical progression, and every condition suitable for the normal reproduction and functioning of labour power is suppressed. The price of labour power and the degree of its exploitation cease to be commensurable quantities. Section 4. Simultaneous variations in the duration, productiveness, and intensity of labor. It is obvious that a large number of combinations are here possible. Any two of the factors may vary and the third remain constant, or all three may vary at once. They may vary either in the same or in different degrees, in the same or in opposite directions, with the result that the variations counteract one another, either wholly or in part. Nevertheless, the analysis of every possible case is easy in view of the results given in sections 1, 2, and 3. The effect of every possible combination may be found by treating each factor in turn as variable, and the other two constant for the time being. We shall therefore notice, and that briefly, but two important cases. A. Diminishing productiveness of labor with a simultaneous lengthening of the working day. In speaking of diminishing productiveness of labor, we here refer to diminution in those industries whose products determine the value of labor power. Such a diminution, for example, as results from decreasing fertility of the soil and from the corresponding dearness of its products. Take the working day at 12 hours and the value created by it at 6 shillings, of which one half replaces the value of the labor power, the other forms the surplus value. Suppose, in consequence of the increased dearness of the products of the soil, that the value of labor power rises from 3 shillings to 4, and therefore the necessary labor time from 6 hours to 8. If there be no change in the length of the working day, the surplus labor would fall from 6 hours to 4, the surplus value from 3 shillings to 2. If the day be lengthened by 2 hours, that is, from 12 hours to 14, the surplus labor remains at 6 hours, the surplus value at 3 shillings. But the surplus value decreases compared with the value of labor power, as measured by the necessary labor time. If the day be lengthened by 4 hours, viz. From 12 hours to 16, the proportional magnitudes of surplus value and value of labor power, of surplus labor and necessary labor, continue unchanged, but the absolute magnitude of surplus value rises from 3 shillings to 4, that of the surplus labor from 6 hours to 8, an increment of 33 1/3%. Therefore, with diminishing productiveness of labor and a simultaneous lengthening of the working day, the absolute magnitude of surplus value may continue unaltered, at the same time that its relative magnitude diminishes. Its relative magnitude may continue unchanged, at the same time that its absolute magnitude increases. And, provided the lengthening of the day be sufficient, both may increase. In the period between 1799 and 1815, the increasing price of provisions led in England to a nominal rise in wages, although the real wages, expressed in the necessaries of life, fell. From this fact, West and Ricardo drew the conclusion that the diminution in the productiveness of agricultural labor had brought about a fall in the rate of surplus value, and they made this assumption of a fact that existed only in their imaginations the starting point of important investigations into the relative magnitudes of wages, profits, and rent. But as a matter of fact, surplus value had at that time, thanks to the increased intensity of labor and to the prolongation of the working day, increased both in absolute and relative magnitude. Footnote. Corn and labor rarely march quite abreast, but there is an obvious limit beyond which they cannot be separated. With regard to the unusual exertions made by the laboring classes in periods of dearness, which produced the fall of wages noticed in the evidence, namely before the Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry 1814-15, They are most meritorious in the individuals, and certainly favour the growth of capital. But no man of humanity could wish to see them constant and unremitted. They are most admirable as a temporary relief, but if they were constantly in action, effects of a similar kind would result from them, as from the population of a country being pushed to the very extreme limits of its food. Malthus, Inquiry into the Nature and Progress of Rent, 1815. All honour to Malthus that he lays stress on the lengthening of the hours of labour, a fact to which he elsewhere in his pamphlet draws attention, while Ricardo and others, in face of the most notorious facts, make invariability in the length of the working day the groundwork of all their investigations. But the conservative interests which Malthus served prevented him from seeing that an unlimited prolongation of the working day, combined with an extraordinary development of machinery and the exploitation of women and children, must inevitably have made a great portion of the working class supernumerary, particularly whenever the war should have ceased, and the monopoly of England in the markets of the world should have come to an end. It was, of course, far more convenient and much more in conformity with the interests of the ruling classes, whom Malthus adored like a true priest, to explain this overpopulation by the eternal laws of nature, rather than by the historical laws of capitalist production. End of footnote. This was the period in which the right to prolong the hours of labour to an outrageous extent was established, the period that was especially characterised by an accelerated accumulation of capital here, by pauperism there. Footnote. A principal cause of the increase of capital during the war proceeded from the greater exertions, and perhaps the greater privations, of the labouring classes, the most numerous in every society. More women and children were compelled by necessitous circumstances to enter upon laborious occupations, and former workmen were, from the same cause, obliged to devote a greater portion of their time to increase production. Essays on Political Economy, in which are illustrated the principal causes of the present national distress. 1830. End of footnote. B. Increasing intensity and productiveness of labour with simultaneous shortening of the working day. Increased productiveness and greater intensity of labour both have a like effect. They both augment the mass of articles produced in a given time. Both, therefore, shorten that portion of the working day which the labourer needs to produce his means of subsistence or their equivalent. The minimum length of the working day is fixed by this necessary but contractile portion of it. If the whole working day were to shrink to the length of this portion, surplus labour would vanish, a consummation utterly impossible under the regime of capital. Only by suppressing the capitalist form of production could the length of the working day be reduced to the necessary labour time. But even in that case, the latter would extend its limits. On the one hand, because the notion of means of subsistence would considerably expand, and the labourer would lay claim to an altogether different standard of life. On the other hand, because a part of what is now surplus labour would then count as necessary labour, I mean the labour of forming a fund for reserve and accumulation. The more the productiveness of labour increases, the more can the working day be shortened, and the more the working day is shortened, the more can the intensity of labour increase. From a social point of view, the productiveness increases in the same ratio as the economy of labour, which in its turn includes not only economy of the means of production, but also the avoidance of all useless labour. The capitalist mode of production, while on the one hand enforcing economy in each individual business, on the other hand begets, by its anarchical system of competition, the most outrageous squandering of labour power and of the social means of production, not to mention the creation of a vast number of employments, at present indispensable, but in themselves superfluous. The intensity and productiveness of labour being given, the time which society is bound to devote to material production is shorter, and as a consequence, the time at its disposal for the free development, intellectual and social, of the individual is greater in proportion as the work is more and more evenly divided among all the able-bodied members of society, and as a particular class is more and more deprived of the power to shift the natural burden of labour from its own shoulders to those of another layer of society. In this direction, the shortening of the working day finds at last a limit in the generalisation of labour. In capitalist society, spare time is acquired for one class by converting the whole lifetime of the masses into labour time. Chapter 18. Various formulae for the rate of surplus value. We have seen that the rate of surplus value is represented by the following formulae. 1. Surplus value over variable capital, S over V, equals surplus value over value of labour power, equals surplus labour over necessary labour. The two first of these formulae represent, as a ratio of values, that which in the third is represented as a ratio of the times during which those values are produced. These formulae, supplementary the one to the other, are rigorously definite and correct. We therefore find them substantially, but not consciously, worked out in classical political economy. There we meet with the following derivative formulae. 2. Surplus labour over working day equals surplus value over value of the product equals surplus product over total product. One and the same ratio is here expressed as a ratio of labour times, of the values in which those labour times are embodied, and of the products in which those values exist. It is, of course, understood that by value of the product is meant only the value newly created in a working day, the constant part of the value of the product being excluded. In all of these formulae, too, the actual degree of exploitation of labour, or the rate of surplus value, is falsely expressed. Let the working day be 12 hours. Then, making the same assumptions as in former instances, the real degree of exploitation of labour will be represented in the following proportions. 6 hours surplus labour over 6 hours necessary labour equals surplus value of 3 shillings over variable capital of 3 shillings equals 100%. From formulae 2, we get very differently. 6 hours surplus labour over working day of 12 hours equals surplus value of 3 shillings over value created of 6 shillings equals 50%. These derivative formulae express in reality only the proportion in which the working day, or the value produced by it, is divided between capitalist and labourer. If they are to be treated as direct expressions of the degree of self-expansion of capital, the following erroneous law would hold good. Surplus labour or surplus value can never reach 100%. Footnote. Thus, for example, in Dritter Brief an von Kirchmann von Robertus, Berlin 1851. I shall return to this letter later on. In spite of its erroneous theory of rent, it sees through the nature of capitalist production. Note added in the third German edition. It may be seen from this how favourably Marx judged his predecessors whenever he found in them real progress or new and sound ideas. The subsequent publication of Rodbertus's letters to Dr. Rudolf Meyer has shown that this acknowledgement by Marx wants restricting to some extent. In those letters, this passage occurs. Capital must be rescued not only from labour but from itself, and that will be best effected by treating the acts of the industrial capitalist as economic and political functions that have been delegated to him with his capital, and by treating his profit as a form of salary, because we still know no other social organisation. But salaries may be regulated, and may also be reduced if they take too much from wages. The irruption of Marx into society, as I may call his book, must be warded off. Altogether, Marx's book is not so much an investigation into capital as a polemic against the present form of capital, a form which he confounds with the concept itself of capital. To such ideological commonplaces did the bold attack by Rodbertus in his Social Letters finally dwindle down. Friedrich Engels, end of footnote. Since the surplus labour is only an aliquot part of the working day, or since surplus value is only an aliquot part of the value created, the surplus labour must necessarily be always less than the working day, or the surplus value always less than the total value created. In order, however, to attain the ratio of 100 to 100, they must be equal. In order that the surplus labour may absorb the whole day, that is, an average day of any week or year, the necessary labour must sink to zero. But if the necessary labour vanish, so too does the surplus labour, since it is only a function of the former. The ratio surplus labour over working day, or surplus value over value created, can therefore never reach the limit 100 over 100, still less rise to 100 plus X over 100, but not so the rate of surplus value, the real degree of exploitation of labour. Take, for example, the estimate of L. de la Verne, according to which the English agricultural labourer gets only 1/4, the capitalist farmer, on the other hand, 3/4, of the product or its value. Apart from the question of how the booty is subsequently divided between the capitalist, the landlord, and others. According to this, this surplus labour of the English agricultural labourer is to his necessary labour as 3 to 1, which gives a rate of exploitation of 300%. Footnote. That part of the product which merely replaces the constant capital advanced is, of course, left out in this calculation. Mr. L. de la Verne, a blind admirer of England, is inclined to estimate the share of the capitalist too low rather than too high. End of footnote. The favourite method of treating the working day as constant in magnitude became, through the use of formulae too, a fixed usage, because in them surplus labour is always compared with a working day of given length. The same holds good when the repartition of the value produced is exclusively kept in sight. The working day that has already been realised in given value must necessarily be a day of given length. The habit of representing surplus value and value of labour power as fractions of the value created, a habit that originates in the capitalist mode of production itself, and whose import will hereafter be disclosed, conceals the very transaction that characterizes capital, namely the exchange of variable capital for living labour power, and the consequent exclusion of the labourer from the product. Instead of the real fact, we have a false semblance of an association, in which labourer and capitalist divide the product in proportion to the different elements which they respectively contribute towards its formation. Footnote. All well-developed forms of capitalist production being forms of cooperation, nothing is, of course, easier than to make abstraction from their antagonistic character, and to transform them, by a word, into some form of free association, as is done by A. de la Borde in De l'Esprit d'Association, dans tous les intérêts de la communauté. Paris, 1818. H. Carey, the Yankee, occasionally performs this conjuring trick with like success, even with the relations resulting from slavery. End of footnote. Moreover, the Formulae 2 can at any time be reconverted into Formulae 1. If, for instance, we have surplus labour of 6 hours over working day of 12 hours, then the necessary labour time being 12 hours less the surplus labour of 6 hours, we get the following result. Surplus labour of 6 hours over necessary labour of 6 hours equals 100/100. There is a third formula which I have occasionally already anticipated. It is 3. Surplus value over value of labour power equals surplus labour over necessary labour equals unpaid labour over paid labour. After the investigations we have given above, it is no longer possible to be misled by the formula unpaid labour over paid labour into concluding that the capitalist pays for labour and not for labour power. This formula is only a popular expression for surplus labour over necessary labour. The capitalist pays the value, so far as price coincides with value, of the labour power, and receives in exchange the disposal of the living labour power itself. His usufruct is spread over 2 periods. During one, the labourer produces a value that is only equal to the value of his labour power. He produces its equivalent. This the capitalist receives in return for his advance of the price of the labour power, a product ready-made in the market. During the other period, the period of surplus labour, the usufruct of the labour power creates a value for the capitalist that costs him no equivalent. Footnote. Although the physiocrats could not penetrate the mystery of surplus value, yet this much was clear to them, viz., that it is a wealth which is independent and disposable, which he has not bought, and which he sells. Turgot, Réflexions sur la formation et la distribution des richesses. This expenditure of labour power comes to him gratis. In this sense, it is that surplus labour can be called unpaid labour. Capital, therefore, is not only, as Adam Smith says, the command over labour, it is essentially the command over unpaid labour. All surplus value, whatever particular form, profit, interest, or rent, it may subsequently crystallise into, is in substance the materialisation of unpaid labour. The secret of the self-expansion of capital resolves itself into having the disposal of a definite quantity of other people's unpaid labour. Part 6. Wages. Chapter 19. The Transformation of the Value and Respective Price of Labour Power into Wages. On the surface of bourgeois society, the wage of the labourer appears as the price of labour, a certain quantity of money that is paid for a certain quantity of labour. Thus people speak of the value of labour, and call its expression in money its necessary or natural price. On the other hand, they speak of the market prices of labour, that is, prices oscillating above or below its natural price. But what is the value of a commodity? The objective form of the social labour expended in its production. And how do we measure the quantity of this value? By the quantity of the labour contained in it. How, then, is the value, for example, of a 12-hour working day, to be determined? By the 12 working hours contained in a working day of 12 hours, which is an absurd tautology. Footnote. Mr. Ricardo, ingeniously enough, avoids a difficulty which, on a first view, threatens to encumber his doctrine that value depends on the quantity of labour employed in production. If this principle is rigidly adhered to, it follows that the value of labour depends on the quantity of labour employed in producing it, which is evidently absurd. By a dexterous turn, therefore, Mr. Ricardo makes the value of labour depend on the quantity of labour required to produce wages. Or, to give him the benefit of his own language, he maintains that the value of labour is to be estimated by the quantity of labour required to produce wages, by which he means the quantity of labour required to produce the money or commodities given to the labourer. This is similar to saying that the value of cloth is estimated not by the quantity of labour bestowed on its production, but by the quantity of labour bestowed on the production of the silver for which the cloth is exchanged. A critical dissertation on the nature, etc., of value. End of footnote. In order to be sold as a commodity in the market, labour must at all events exist before it is sold. But could the labourer give it an independent objective existence, he would sell a commodity and not labour. Footnote. If you call labour a commodity, it is not like a commodity which is first produced in order to exchange, and then brought to market where it must exchange with other commodities, according to the respective quantities of each which there may be in the market at the time. Labour is created the moment it is brought to market. Nay, it is brought to market before it is created. Observations on certain verbal disputes, etc. End of footnote. Apart from these contradictions, a direct exchange of money, that is, of realized labour with living labour, would either do away with the law of value which only begins to develop itself freely on the basis of capitalist production, or do away with capitalist production itself, which rests directly on wage labour. The working day of 12 hours embodies itself, for example, in a money value of 6 shillings. Either equivalents are exchanged, and then the labourer receives 6 shillings for 12 hours labour. The price of his labour would be equal to the price of his product. In this case, he produces no surplus value for the buyer of his labour. The 6 shillings are not transformed into capital. The basis of capitalist production vanishes. But it is on this very basis that he sells his labour, and that his labour is wage labour. Or else, he receives for 12 hours labour less than 6 shillings, that is, less than 12 hours labour. 12 hours labour are exchanged against 10, 6, etc. hours labour. This equalization of unequal quantities not merely does away with the determination of value. Such a self-destructive contradiction cannot be in any way even enunciated or formulated as a law. Footnote. Treating labour as a commodity, and capital, the produce of labour, as another, then, if the values of these two commodities were regulated by equal quantities of labour, a given amount of labour would exchange for that quantity of capital which had been produced by the same amount of labour. Antecedent labour would exchange for the same amount as present labour. But the value of labour in relation to other commodities is determined not by equal quantities of labour. E.G. Wakefield, in his edition of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, 1836, end of footnote. It is of no avail to deduce the exchange of more labour against less from their difference of form, the one being realized, the other living. Footnote. There has to be a new agreement, a new edition of the social contract, that whenever there is an exchange of work done for work to be done, the capitalist is to receive a higher value than the worker. Simon de Sismondi, De la Richesse Commerciale, Geneva, 1803. End of footnote. This is the more absurd, as the value of a commodity is determined not by the quantity of labour actually realised in it, but by the quantity of living labour necessary for its production. A commodity represents, say, 6 working hours. If an invention is made by which it can be produced in 3 hours, the value, even of the commodity already produced, falls by half. It represents now 3 hours of social labour instead of the 6 formerly necessary. It is the quantity of labour required for its production, not the realised form of that labour, by which the amount of the value of a commodity is determined. That which comes directly face to face with the possessor of money on the market is in fact not labour, but the labourer. What the latter sells is his labour power. As soon as his labour actually begins, it has already ceased to belong to him. It can therefore no longer be sold by him. Labour is the substance, and the immanent measure of value, but has itself no value. Footnote: labour, the exclusive standard of value, the creator of all wealth, no commodity. Thomas Hodgkin, Popular Political Economy, end of footnote. In the expression value of labour, the idea of value is not only completely obliterated, but actually reversed. It is an expression as imaginary as the value of the earth. These imaginary expressions arise, however, from the relations of production themselves. They are categories for the phenomenal forms of essential relations. That in their appearance things often represent themselves in inverted form is pretty well known in every science except political economy. Footnote. On the other hand, the attempt to explain such expressions as merely poetic license only shows the impotence of the analysis. Hence, in answer to Proudhon's phrase, labour is called value, not as being a commodity itself, but in view of the values supposed to be potentially embodied in it, the value of labour is a figurative expression, etc., I have remarked, in labour, commodity, which is a frightful reality, he, Proudhon, sees nothing but a grammatical ellipsis. The whole of existing society, then, based upon labour commodity, is henceforth based upon a poetic license, on a figurative expression. Does society desire to eliminate all the inconveniences which trouble it? It has only to eliminate all the ill-sounding terms. Let it change the language, and for that it has only to address itself to the Academy and ask it for a new edition of its dictionary. Karl Marx, Misère de la Philosophie. It is naturally still more convenient to understand by value nothing at all. Then one can without difficulty subsume everything under this category. Thus, for example, J.B. Say. What is value? Answer, that which a thing is worth. And what is price? Answer, the value of a thing expressed in money. And why has agriculture a value? Answer, because one sets a price on it. Therefore, value is what a thing is worth, and the land has its value because its value is expressed in money. This is, anyhow, a very simple way of explaining the why and the wherefore of things. End of footnote. Classical political economy borrowed from everyday life the category price of labour, without further criticism, and then simply asked the question, how is this price determined? It soon recognised that the change in the relations of demand and supply, explained in regard to the price of labour, as of all other commodities, nothing except its changes, that is, the oscillations of the market price above or below a certain mean. If demand and supply balance, the oscillation of prices ceases, all other conditions remaining the same. But then demand and supply also cease to explain anything. The price of labour, at the moment when demand and supply are in equilibrium, is its natural price, determined independently of the relation of demand and supply. And how this price is determined is just a question. Or a larger period of oscillations in the market price is taken, for example a year, and they are found to cancel one the other, leaving a mean average quantity, a relatively constant magnitude. This had naturally to be determined otherwise than by its own compensating variations. This price, which always finally predominates over the accidental market prices of labour and regulates them, this necessary price, physiocrats, or natural price of labour, Adam Smith, can, as with all other commodities, be nothing else than its value expressed in money. In this way, political economy expected to penetrate, athwart the accidental prices of labour, to the value of labour. As with other commodities, this value was determined by the cost of production. But what is the cost of production of the labourer, that is, the cost of producing or reproducing the labourer himself? This question unconsciously substituted itself in political economy for the original one. For the search after the cost of production of labour as such turned in a circle and never left the spot. What economists therefore call value of labour is in fact the value of labour power, as it exists in the personality of the labourer, which is as different from its function, labour, as a machine is from the work it performs. Occupied with the difference between the market price of labour and its so-called value, with the relation of this value to the rate of profit and to the values of the commodities produced by means of labour, etc., they never discovered that the course of the analysis had led not only from the market prices of labour to its presumed value, but had led to the resolution of this value of labour itself into the value of labour power. Classical economy never arrived at a consciousness of the results of its own analysis. It accepted uncritically the categories value of labour, natural price of labour, etc., as final and as adequate expressions for the value relation under consideration, and was thus led, as will be seen later, into inextricable confusion and contradiction, while it offered to the vulgar economists a secure basis of operations for their shallowness, which on principle worships appearances only. Let us next see how value and price of labour power present themselves in this transformed condition as wages. We know that the daily value of labour power is calculated upon a certain length of the labourer's life, to which, again, corresponds a certain length of working day. Assume the habitual working day as 12 hours, the daily value of labour power as 3 shillings, the expression in money of a value that embodies 6 hours of labour. If the labourer receives 3 shillings, then he receives the value of his labour power functioning through 12 hours. If, now, this value of a day's labour power is expressed as the value of a day's labour itself, we have the formula 12 hours labour has a value of 3 shillings. The value of labour power thus determines the value of labour, or expressed in money, its necessary price. If, on the other hand, the price of labour power differs from its value, in like manner, the price of labour differs from its so-called value. As the value of labour is only an irrational expression for the value of labour power, it follows, of course, that the value of labour must always be less than the value it produces, for the capitalist always makes labour power work longer than is necessary for the reproduction of its own value. In our example, the value of the labour power that functions through 12 hours is 3 shillings, a value for the reproduction of which 6 hours are required. The value which the labour power produces is, on the other hand, 6 shillings, because it, in fact, functions during 12 hours, and the value it produces depends not on its own value, but on the length of time it is in action. Thus, we have a result absurd at first sight, that labour which creates a value of 6 shillings possesses a value of 3 shillings. Footnote. Compare Zur Kritik, etc., where I state that, in the portion of that work that deals with capital, this problem will be solved. How does production, on the basis of exchange value determined simply by labour time, lead to the result that the exchange value of labour is less than the exchange value of its product? End of footnote. We see further, the value of 3 shillings, by which a part only of the working day, that is 6 hours labour, is paid for, appears as the value or price of the whole working day of 12 hours, which thus includes 6 hours unpaid for. The wage form thus extinguishes every trace of the division of the working day into necessary labour and surplus labour, into paid and unpaid labour. All labour appears as paid labour. In the corvée, the labour of the worker for himself and his compulsory labour for his lord differ in space and time in the clearest possible way. In slave labour, even that part of the working day in which the slave is only replacing the value of his own means of existence, in which, therefore, in fact, he works for himself alone, appears as labour for his master. All the slave's labour appears as unpaid labour. Footnote: The Morning Star, a London free trade organ, naïf to silliness, protested again and again during the American Civil War, with all the moral indignation of which man is capable, that the Negro in the Confederate States worked absolutely for nothing. It should have compared the daily cost of such a Negro with that of the free workman in the East End of London. End of footnote. In wage labour, on the contrary, even surplus labour or unpaid labour appears as paid. There, the property relation conceals the labour of the slave for himself. Here, the money relation conceals the unrequited labour of the wage labourer. Hence, we may understand the decisive importance of the transformation of value and price of labour power into the form of wages, or into the value and price of labour itself. This phenomenal form, which makes the actual relation invisible, and indeed shows the direct opposite of that relation, forms the basis of all the juridical notions of both labourer and capitalist, of all the mystification of the capitalistic mode of production, of all its illusions as to liberty, of all the apologetic shifts of the vulgar economists. If history took a long time to get at the bottom of the mystery of wages, nothing, on the other hand, is more easy to understand than the necessity, the raison d'être, of this phenomenon. The exchange between capital and labour at first presents itself to the mind in the same guise as the buying and selling of all other commodities. The buyer gives a certain sum of money, the seller an article of a nature different from money. The jurist's consciousness recognizes in this, at most, a material difference, expressed in the juridically equivalent formula, I give in order that you may give, I give in order that you may produce, I produce so that you may give, I produce so that you may produce. Furthermore, exchange value and use value being intrinsically incommensurable magnitudes, the expressions value of labour, price of labour, do not seem more irrational than the expressions value of cotton, price of cotton. Moreover, the labourer is paid after he has given his labour. In its function of means of payment, money realises subsequently the value or price of the article supplied, that is, in this particular case, the value or price of the labour supplied. Finally, the use value supplied by the labourer to the capitalist is not in fact his labour power, but its function. Some definite useful labour, the work of tailoring, shoemaking, spinning, etc. That this same labour is, on the other hand, the universal value-creating element, and thus possesses a property by which it differs from all other commodities, is beyond the cognizance of the ordinary mind. Let us put ourselves in the place of the labourer who receives for 12 hours' labour, say, the value produced by 6 hours' labour, say, 3 shillings. For him, in fact, his 12 hours' labour is the means of buying the 3 shillings. The value of his labour power may vary with the value of his usual means of subsistence, from 3 to 4 shillings, or from 3 to 2 shillings, or, if the value of his labour power remains constant, its price may, in consequence of changing relations of demand and supply, rise to 4 shillings or fall to 2 shillings. He always gives 12 hours of labour. Every change in the amount of the equivalent that he receives appears to him, therefore, necessarily as a change in the value or price of his 12 hours' work. This circumstance misled Adam Smith, who treated the working day as a constant quantity, to the assertion that the value of labour is constant, although the value of the means of subsistence may vary, and the same working day, therefore, may represent itself in more or less money for the labourer. Footnote: Adam Smith only accidentally alludes to the variation of the working day when he is referring to piece wages. End of footnote. Let us consider, on the other hand, the capitalist. He wishes to receive as much labour as possible for as little money as possible. Practically, therefore, the only thing that interests him is the difference between the price of labour power and the value which its function creates. But then he tries to buy all commodities as cheaply as possible, and always accounts for his profit by simple cheating, by buying under and selling over the value. Hence, he never comes to see that, if such a thing as the value of labour really existed, and he really paid this value, no capital would exist. His money would not be turned into capital. Moreover, the actual movement of wages presents phenomena which seem to prove that not the value of labour power is paid, but the value of its function, of labour itself. We may reduce these phenomena to two great classes. 1. Change of wages with the changing length of the working day. One might as well conclude that not the value of a machine is paid, but that of its working, because it costs more to hire a machine for a week than for a day. 2. The individual difference in the wages of different labourers who do the same kind of work. We find this individual difference, but are not deceived by it, in the system of slavery, where, frankly and openly, without any circumlocution, labour power itself is sold. Only, in the slave system, the advantage of a labour power above the average, and the disadvantage of a labour power below the average, affects the slave owner. In the wage-labour system, it affects the labourer himself, because his labour power is, in the one case sold by himself, in the other by a third person. For the rest, in respect to the phenomenal form, value and price of labour, or wages, as contrasted with the essential relation manifested therein, viz. The value and price of labour power, the same difference holds that holds in respect to all phenomena and their hidden substratum. The former appear directly and spontaneously as current modes of thought, the latter must first be discovered by science. Classical political economy nearly touches the true relation of things without, however, consciously formulating it. This it cannot, so long as it sticks in its bourgeois skin. Chapter 20. Time Wages. Wages themselves again take many forms, a fact not recognisable in the ordinary economic treatises, which, exclusively interested in the material side of the question, neglect every difference of form. An exposition of all these forms, however, belongs to the special study of wage labour, not, therefore, to this work. Still, the two fundamental forms must be briefly worked out here. The sale of labour power, as will be remembered, takes place for a definite period of time. The converted form under which the daily, weekly, etc. value of labour power presents itself is hence that of time wages, therefore day wages, etc. Next, it is to be noted that the laws set forth in the 17th chapter on the changes in the relative magnitudes of price of labour power and surplus value pass by a simple transformation of form into laws of wages. Similarly, the distinction between the exchange value of labour power and the sum of the necessaries of life into which this value is converted now reappears as the distinction between nominal and real wages. It would be useless to repeat here, with regard to the phenomenal form, what has been already worked out in the substantial form. We limit ourselves, therefore, to a few points characteristic of time wages. The sum of money which the labourer receives for his daily or weekly labour forms the amount of his nominal wages, or of his wages estimated in value. Footnote: the value of money itself is here always supposed constant. End of footnote. But it is clear that according to the length of the working day, that is, according to the amount of actual labour daily supplied, the same daily or weekly wage may represent very different prices of labour, that is, very different sums of money for the same quantity of labour. Footnote: the price of labour is the sum paid for a given quantity of labour. Sir Edward West, Price of Corn and Wages of Labour, London, 1836. West is the author of the anonymous Essay on the Application of Capital to Land, by a fellow of the University College of Oxford, London, 1815. An epoch-making work in the history of political economy. End of footnote. We must, therefore, in considering time wages, again distinguish between the sum total of the daily or weekly wages, etc., and the price of labour. How, then, to find this price, that is, the money value of a given quantity of labour? The average price of labour is found when the average daily value of the labour power is divided by the average number of hours in the working day. If, for example, the daily value of labour power is 3 shillings, the value of the product is 6 working hours, and if the working day is 12 hours, the price of 1 working hour is 3/12 shillings, equals 3d. The price of the working hour thus found serves as the unit measure for the price of labour. It follows, therefore, that the daily and weekly wages, etc., may remain the same, although the price of labour falls constantly. If, for example, the habitual working day is 10 hours, and the daily value of the labour power 3 shillings, the price of the working hour is 3 3/5 pennies. It falls to 3 shillings as soon as the working day rises to 12 hours, to 2 2/5 pennies as soon as it rises to 15 hours. Daily or weekly wages remain, despite all this, unchanged. On the contrary, the daily or weekly wages may rise, although the price of labour remains constant or even falls. If, for example, the working day is 10 hours and the daily value of labour power 3 shillings, the price of 1 working hour is 3 3/5 pence. If the labourer, in consequence of increase of trade, works 12 hours, the price of labour remaining the same, his daily wage now rises to 3 shillings 7 1/5 penny, without any variation in the price of labour. The same result might follow if, instead of the extensive amount of labour, its intensive amount increased. Footnote: the wages of labour depend upon the price of labour and the quantity of labour performed. An increase in the wages of labour does not necessarily imply an enhancement of the price of labour. From fuller employment and greater exertions, the wages of labour may be considerably increased, while the price of labour may continue the same. Sir Edward West. The main question, how is the price of labour determined, West, however, dismisses with mere banalities. End of footnote. The rise of the nominal daily or weekly wages may therefore be accompanied by a price of labour that remains stationary or falls. The same holds as to the income of the labourer's family. As soon as the quantity of labour expended by the head of the family is increased by the labour of the members of his family. There are, therefore, methods of lowering the price of labour independent of the reduction of the nominal daily or weekly wages. Footnote: this is perceived by the fanatical representative of the industrial bourgeoisie of the 18th century, the author of the Essay on Trade and Commerce, often quoted by us, although he puts the matter in a confused way. It is the quantity of labour, and not the price of it. He means by this the nominal daily or weekly wages. That is determined by the price of provisions and other necessaries. Reduce the price of necessaries very low, and of course you reduce the quantity of labour in proportion. Master manufacturers know that there are various ways of raising and felling the price of labour, besides that of altering its nominal amount. In his three lectures on the rate of wages, London 1830, in which M.W. Senior uses West's work without mentioning it, he says, "The labourer is principally interested in the amount of wages. That is to say, the labourer is principally interested in what he receives, the nominal sum of his wages, not in that which he gives, the amount of labour." End of footnote. As a general law, it follows that, given the amount of daily or weekly labour, etc., the daily or weekly wages depend on the price of labour, which itself varies either with the value of labour power or with the difference between its price and its value. Given, on the other hand, the price of labour, the daily or weekly wages depend on the quantity of the daily or weekly labour. The unit measure for time wages, the price of the working hour, is the quotient of the value of a day's labour power divided by the number of hours of the average working day. Let the latter be 12 hours, and the daily value of labour power 3 shillings, the value of the product of 6 hours of labour. Under these circumstances, the price of a working hour is 3d. The value produced in it is 6d. If the labourer is now employed less than 12 hours, or less than 6 days in the week, for example, only 6 or 8 hours, he receives, with this price of labour, only 2 shillings, or 1 and 6d, a day. Footnote. The effect of such an abnormal lessening of employment is quite different from that of a general reduction of the working day enforced by law. The former has nothing to do with the absolute length of the working day, and may occur just as well in a working day of 15 as of 6 hours. The normal price of labour is, in the first case, calculated on the labourer working 15 hours, in the second case on his working 6 hours a day on the average. The result is therefore the same if he, in the one case, is employed only for 7.5, in the other, only for 3 hours. End of footnote. As on our hypothesis he must work on the average 6 hours daily in order to produce a day's wage corresponding merely to the value of his labour power, as, according to the same hypothesis, he works only half of every hour for himself and half for the capitalist, it is clear that he cannot obtain for himself the value of the product of 6 hours if he is employed less than 12 hours. In previous chapters we saw the destructive consequences of overwork. Here we find the sources of the sufferings that result to the labourer from his insufficient employment. If the hour's wage is fixed so that the capitalist does not bind himself to pay a day's or a week's wage, but only to pay wages for the hours during which he chooses to employ the labourer, he can employ him for a shorter time than that which is originally the basis of the calculation of the hour wage, or the unit measure of the price of labour. Since this unit is determined by the ratio daily value of labour power over working day of a given number of hours, it, of course, loses all meaning as soon as the working day ceases to contain a definite number of hours. The connection between the paid and the unpaid labour is destroyed. The capitalist can now wring from the labour a certain quantity of surplus labour without allowing him the labour time necessary for his own subsistence. He can annihilate all regularity of employment, and according to his own convenience, caprice, and the interest of the moment, make the most enormous overwork alternate with relative or absolute cessation of work. He can, under the pretense of paying the normal price of labour, abnormally lengthen the working day without any corresponding compensation to the labourer. Hence the perfectly rational revolt in 1860 of the London labourers employed in the building trades against the attempt of the capitalists to impose on them this sort of wage by the hour, The legal limitation of the working day puts an end to such mischief, although not, of course, to the diminution of employment caused by the competition of machinery, by changes in the quality of the labourers employed, and by crises, partial or general. With an increasing daily or weekly wage, the price of labour may remain nominally constant, and yet may fall below its normal level. This occurs every time that the price of labour, reckoned per working hour, remaining constant, the working day is prolonged beyond its customary length. If, in the fraction daily value of labour power over working day, the denominator increases, the numerator increases yet more rapidly. The value of labour power, as dependent on its wear and tear, increases with the duration of its functioning, and in more rapid proportion than the increase of that duration. In many branches of industry where time wage is the general rule without legal limits to the working time, the habit has therefore spontaneously grown up of regarding the working day as normal only up to a certain point, for example, up to the expiration of the 10th hour. Normal working day, the day's work, the regular hours of work. Beyond this limit, the working time is overtime, and is, taking the hour as unit measure, paid better, extra pay, although often in a proportion ridiculously small. Footnote. Quote, the rate of payment for overtime in lace-making is so small from 1 halfpenny and 3/4 of a penny to 2d per hour that it stands in painful contrast to the amount of injury produced to the health and stamina of the workpeople. The small amount thus earned is also often obliged to be spent in extra nourishment. Unquote. The normal working day exists here as a fraction of the actual working day, and the latter, often during the whole year, lasts longer than the former. Footnote. For example, in paper staining before the recent introduction into this trade of the Factory Act, quote, we work on with no stoppage for meals, so that the day's work of 10.5 hours is finished by 4:30 p.m, and all after that is overtime, and we seldom leave off working before 6 p.m, so that we are really working overtime the whole year round. Unquote. End of footnote. The increase in the price of labour with the extension of the working day beyond a certain normal limit takes such a shape in various British industries that the low price of labour during the so-called normal time compels the labourer to work during the better paid overtime, if he wishes to obtain a sufficient wage at all. Footnote. For example, in the Scotch bleaching works. Quote, in some parts of Scotland, this trade, before the introduction of the Factory Act in 1862, was carried on by a system of overtime, that is, 10 hours a day were the regular hours of work, for which a nominal wage of 1 2d per day was paid to a man, there being every day overtime for 3 or 4 hours, paid at the rate of 3d per hour. The effect of this system, a man could not earn more than 8 shillings per week when working the ordinary hours. Without overtime, they could not earn a fair day's wages. The higher wages, for getting adult males to work longer hours, are a temptation too strong to be resisted. Unquote. The bookbinding trade in the City of London employs very many young girls from 14 to 15 years old, and that under indentures which prescribe certain definite hours of labour. Nevertheless, they work in the last week of each month until 10, 11, 12 or 1 o'clock at night, along with the older labourers in very mixed company. Quote, the masters tempt them by extra pay and supper, unquote, which they eat in neighbouring public houses. The great debauchery thus produced among these young immortals, quote-unquote, is compensated by the fact that among the rest, many Bibles and religious books are bound by them. End of footnote. Legal limitation of the working day puts an end to these amenities. Footnote. With very accurate appreciation of the state of things, the London labourers employed in the building trades declared, during the great strike and lockout of 1860, that they would only accept wages by the hour under two conditions. One, that with the price of the working hour, a normal working day of 9 and 10 hours respectively should be fixed, and that the price of the hour for the 10 hours working day should be higher than that for the hour of the 9 hours working day. Two, that every hour beyond the normal working day should be reckoned as overtime and proportionally more highly paid. End of footnote. It is a fact generally known that the longer the working days in any branch of industry, the lower are the wages. Footnote. Quote, it is a very notable thing, too, that where long hours are the rule, small wages are also so. The work which obtains the scanty pittance of food is, for the most part, excessively prolonged. Unquote. End of footnote. A. Redgrave, factory inspector, illustrates this by a comparative review of the 20 years from 1839 to 1859, according to which wages rose in the factories under the 10 hours law, while they fell in the factories in which the work lasted 14 to 15 hours daily. From the law, the price of labour being given, the daily or weekly wage depends on the quantity of labour expended, it follows, first of all, that the lower the price of labour, the greater must be the quantity of labour, or the longer must be the working day, for the labourer to secure even a miserable average wage. The lowness of the price of labour acts here as a stimulus to the extension of the labour time. Footnote. The hand-nail makers in England, for example, have, on account of the low price of labour, to work 15 hours a day in order to hammer out their miserable weekly wage. Quote, it's a great many hours in a day, 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., and he has to work hard all the time to get 11 pence or 1 shilling, and there is the wear of the tools, the cost of firing, and something for waste iron to go out of this, which takes off altogether 2½ or 3½. Unquote. The women earn, by the same working time, a week's wage of only 5 shillings. End of footnote. On the other hand, the extension of the working time produces, in its turn, a fall in the price of labour, and with this a fall in the day's or week's wages. The determination of the price of labour by daily value of labour power over working day of a given number of hours shows that a mere prolongation of the working day lowers the price of labour, if no compensation steps in. But the same circumstances which allow the capitalist in the long run to prolong the working day also allow him first, and compel him finally, to nominally lower the price of labour until the total price of the increased number of hours is lowered, and therefore the daily or weekly wage. Reference to two circumstances is sufficient here. If one man does the work of 1½ or 2 men, the supply of labour increases, although the supply of labour power on the market remains constant. The competition thus created between the labourers allows the capitalist to beat down the price of labour, whilst the falling price of labour allows him, on the other hand, to screw up still further the working time. Footnote. If a factory hand, for example, refused to work the customary long hours, he would very shortly be replaced by somebody who would work any length of time, and thus be thrown out of employment. Reports of Inspectors of Factories, 1848. Evidence. If one man performs the work of two, the rate of profits will generally be raised, in consequence of the additional supply of labour having diminished its price. Senior. End of footnote. Soon, however, this command over abnormal quantities of unpaid labour, that is, quantities in excess of the average social amount, becomes a source of competition amongst the capitalists themselves. A part of the price of the commodity consists of the price of labour. The unpaid part of the labour price need not be reckoned in the price of the commodity. It may be presented to the buyer. This is the first step to which competition leads. The second step to which it drives is to exclude also from the selling price of the commodity at least a part of the abnormal surplus value created by the extension of the working day. In this way, an abnormally low selling price of the commodity arises, at first sporadically, and becomes fixed by degrees. A lower selling price, which henceforward becomes the constant basis of a miserable wage for an excessive working time, as